revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have an important show on a topic that not a lot of people know about. I think the dental industry has been, I don't know, it's not really well known unless you have an issue and you go to the dentist. But I wanted to speak with somebody about a different type of dentistry, biological dentistry. I want to talk about what we need to do to keep ourselves healthy and also different aspects of dentistry that are actually natural and safe. So I wanted to welcome Dr. Leonard Fazio. He's a dentist who completed his residency at Tufts University Dental School in Boston. He's certified in the field of biologic dentistry and biological oral surgery and dental implantology. There are only about 65 dentists in the world who have this particular education and understand its concepts. What he's doing is revolutionizing the field of oral surgery. It's all about prevention and elimination of disease as opposed to just managing something, which I really love. So I wanted to, one, welcome you, Dr. Fazio, to the show. And I want to thank you for your time because I know you're quite busy. So thank you for joining me today.
Dr. George, it's truly my pleasure to be here to speak with you on this very important subject, which I'm sure you appreciate is near and dear to my heart. Yeah, it is something that I think most people need to hear one way or another during the course of their lifetime in order to start making smart decisions going forward as they visit the dentist.
Absolutely. So let's start off by starting the conversation with, how did you get into holistic dentistry and what exactly is it?
Well, that's a great question. And anytime I give a lecture somewhere, I like to start with that very same approach, which is to let people know where I'm coming from. I didn't just wake up one day and decide I'm going to almost throw away everything I learned in dental school and practice this biological, holistic way. But it was something that was, gosh, I guess a blessing in disguise. I had graduated dental school in 1988. And within about 3 years, I started to develop some symptomology that came on slowly at first, but then kind of snowballed into a full-on problem that affected me from day to day. And those symptoms that I developed included sensitivity to light and sound, having a short fuse. I had no patience for anything. And knowing that that's not my nature, I started to wonder, you know, am I just stressed out? I had digestive disturbances, sleep disorders. There were days I couldn't get out of bed. P.S. I went to my local physician, who at the time was a friend of mine, still a friend of mine. We had every test under the sun run on me, from blood work to scans, EKGs, EEGs, and the like. And his answer to me was that there was nothing wrong with me. And although I explained to him quite earnestly that this is not how I've ever felt in my life, he had no answer for me. And at that time suggested I, quote unquote, go speak to someone, meaning that it probably needed some pharmacology and maybe a mental health evaluation. Well, I was a bit shocked with that answer because he didn't have any other solution, but yet I knew in my heart that was not the issue. Something that I developed within the course, Dr. George, of about 6 months, very quickly that the symptoms escalated. And in my heart, as I said, I knew that that was not the answer. There was no mental health issues in my family. And I just thought something else was happening. And again, he had no answer for me. Serendipitously, right around the same time, one of my older sisters was having her own health issues. In her case, it was searching for alternative therapies to help her thyroid health. At the time, she was very sick and tired of being sick and tired, having her medications adjusted up and down. Her endocrinologist didn't provide her with any sort of long-term relief of her symptoms. And along the way, to help herself, she tried changing her diet, shared that information with the rest of us in the family. She went vegan, vegetarian, tried everything, macrobiotic diets, and which helped her to a certain degree, but yet didn't fix anything. And right around that time, she was seeing a colon hydrotherapist for treatment. And that person suggested to her that she get her silver fillings taken out. And which are the mercury amalgam fillings. And when she came home, my sister, she called me up and said, "Hey, Len, guess what I found out? that the silver fillings are a problem and I'm going to go have them removed by this dentist. And I said, excuse me? Dr. George, that made absolutely no sense to me. You know, I had gone to what I think is a very good school, dental school at NYU. This is only 3 years earlier, and I knew I didn't mishear when they talked to us about amalgam filling, but yet my sister was telling me that she feels that by getting her fillings removed or replaced, that this is going to help her health. I wouldn't give her my blessing. And I think she was a bit crestfallen. I thought she wanted me to be as excited as she was, but none of what she was telling me made any sense. And in fact, just about a month and change prior, 60 Minutes, the television news program, had run a segment in which they had a representative on from the American Dental Association querying him and challenging the position on the safety of amalgam filling. And in that particular program, when the interviewer asked the representative from the American Dental Association, is there any connection to, amalgam, mercury exposure, from the amalgam fillings and ill health in the population? Of course, the interviewee, the representative from the American Dental Association, said there was absolutely no connection, which, you know, was the party line. That's what we were all taught in school, that there's no chance that the mercury in amalgams is going to be posing any health threat. In fact, the person in the interview said that there were no studies to prove anything like that and so forth. Pretty much end of story. However, the last question the interviewer asked was, why is it, and this is what really got me going, why is it that the leftover amalgam filling that didn't make it into the tooth? And Dr. George, let me clarify by saying that dentists who use mercury amalgam fillings always mix a little bit extra of the filling because we don't want to run out with, you know, by not having enough because mm-hmm. every while the filling hardens and you have to kind of start all over again. But why is it, the question asked, why is it that that very same amalgam filling that you mixed up, the extra, let's say, that didn't make it into the tooth, why is that leftover stuff not allowed to be touched with bare hands? Why is that extra material not allowed to be thrown in the garbage? And why does the Environmental Protection Agency classify that extra leftover filling material as toxic material or hazardous waste? And the interviewee had no answer. In fact, it was kind of the proverbial deer in the headlights look. Made some sort of response, but within a week of that broadcast, the American Dental Association had sent out a question and answers letter to all its members, of which I was at the time, saying that essentially that in light of this recent broadcast, you're likely going to get some questions from your patients about the safety of amalgam fillings. And it further went on to say that here are the top five questions and here are the top five answers. And so when my sister, you know, presented this information to me, I said, no, the show was just on. The ADA just sent out this question and answers. This is new information. This is not new information. This has been known for a while. And again, I shot her down. Well, in a roundabout way, I said to my sister, look, if you truly believe this is what's going to happen to you, you know, this is going to help you, then go right ahead and, you know, have your amalgams removed. She had done some reading and she didn't just jump in with both feet, but searched the dentist and seemed that he was legit. And in the aftermath, or I should say after her treatment was over and when she had her fillings replaced, according to a very unusual, crazy, and what I thought at the time, strange protocol, which we now know as the SMART protocol for protection, my sister had an amazing turnaround in her health. Dr. George, I think that most dentists won't be able to accept this information without something personal happening to them. And this is the thing that happened to me where at first I wanted to believe that this couldn't have been the case. And I thought, honestly, that it was a placebo effect, that my sister had been doing all these things to help herself and nothing really gave her the health level that she was looking for. But yet this somehow changed. And when I spoke to her for the first time after she had them out, I almost didn't recognize her voice. And when I saw her for the first time in person, her whole being had changed. And so much so to the point I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. And I subsequently went to the dentist and had lunch with him. And I bluntly asked him, what did you do? And at that time he said, well, it's complicated, but if you want to know more, by this time, Dr. George, it was about January, February of 1992. He suggested that I go to see a dentist by the name of Hal Huggins, rest in peace, out in Colorado in the fall of 1992. And he said, when you get back, let's have lunch and we'll talk. Well, I said, okay, well, I'm going to do that. And come October of 1992, I flew out to Colorado Springs. And as I was sitting in the audience for the lecture, Dr. Huggins was on stage talking about the kind of symptomology that currently presents in or commonly presents in patients with acute mercury poisoning. And as he started rattling off the list of symptoms, I realized he was talking about me. And I looked around, I'm going, oh my God, this is it. I'm looking at everybody else in the audience, nodding their heads, going, yeah, mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, maybe this is true. And maybe this was not what we were taught in school. P.S. I head back to New York after that lecture. I have lunch with the dentist who treated my sister. And as we're talking, he's like, so what'd you think? And I said, I'm all in. He offered me a job on the spot and I took it and I never looked back. And therefore, for me, someone who was relatively new out of school, it was the ideal scenario for me to not only embrace the knowledge, the philosophy of biological dentistry, but to immediately put into practice because I was able to join a practice that was already established. So my situation is unique in the fact that, you know, a door was open for me and I walked right in and closed the door behind me and never looked back. Most dentists don't get that kind of an experience. And so to challenge the dogma, the theories, the education we were received in school is very challenging for them. Even my good friends didn't really want to believe that what I was telling them was the truth. And after I got my amalgams out, I thought maybe that would change their mind and still didn't. So, you know, these beliefs are strongly held. Most dentists are not going to challenge the information or education they learned in school, and that I was labeled the outsider, an outlier, and I didn't care because I knew I was onto the truth. And once you know that, you can't unknow that. And therefore, I just kind of, again, had the good fortune of being in a practice that was already established and became a very good friend to the dentist who treated my sister. And he took me literally under his wing, showed me the ropes. And ever since then, I've been practicing a biological, holistic dentistry that, you know, emphasizes importance on the oral systemic relationship. And I'll tell you, it was one of the most empowering things as a practitioner to go from nothing but a glorified tooth mechanic to now a healing oral health doctor who is intimately, you know, involved with patients' livelihood and, health and well-being. And it really provides a joy to work with, that you go to work knowing that people truly appreciate what you have out there. And it's been serving me well. And I feel very fortunate that as sick as I had gotten, it turned into a blessing in the end to, you know, turn me into this whole new world. And now my practice is, you know, bloomed, especially with the recent, let's say, pandemic and the intense maybe investigation and information that's available for people to now start reading on this and make their own minds up to decide, do I want toxic materials in my mouth? Do I want to embrace a new, different philosophy that is health-centered and not disease-centered? And that's where we're at right now. Thankfully, there are plenty more dentists now than when I started in 1992. And I see that trend growing, fortunately, for the population out there.
Wow, what a testimonial. That is powerful. And it's actually a double-edged sword. It's kind of maddening, actually, that colleagues who know you,
yeah,
who see the change in you, just they're baffled and they deny that something is different than what they trained on. And it seems to be a problem.
I was going to say, I think maybe why one of the reasons, again, if you're a freshman in dental school, and here is the rebuttal I gave to my sister right away. In dental school, in first year among all the classes, we take a class called dental materials. Now, I'm so old that back in the day, you know, we're instructors writing on a chalkboard and you're copying notes or making notes and so forth. And on the day we were learning about amalgam filling, he's writing out, okay, amalgam filling, and he's writing down the components. And he's writing, let's say, mercury, 40 to 50%, silver, 10 to 20 or 30%, followed by, you know, zinc, copper, and so forth. And as he writes mercury, we're all like looking at each other in the class, we go, mercury, isn't that bad for you? Isn't that, that's what's in tuna, right? And too much of that's no good. Well, the instructor turns around. He goes, all right, hold it, everybody. Quiet, please. Yes, there's mercury in amalgam filling. But once you mix it with the silver, the tin, the copper, and the zinc to make the amalgam, the mercury is neutralized. It becomes inert and therefore is non-toxic. Oh, okay. End of conversation. We never spoke about it again. So right from day one, we're taught that, yes, there's mercury in it, but don't worry about it. Don't respect it. That mercury is somehow magically non-toxic when you put it into the filling. Of course, we know better today. So it's hard, you know, for people to, again, it's ingrained in you. And, you know, you want to have the knowledge that what you were taught in school is going to serve you well as a practitioner, and that anybody who challenges that is the heretic. And that's come all along. I should say it's come a long way, where there's a newer generation of dentists who are now realizing that, you know, there's something else out there that's better. It just makes sense to be a biological dentist.
It absolutely does. On that note, let's take our first break, because I want to delve into mercury and what its effects are. So let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Fazio, and it was a wonderful synopsis of how you came to this revelation about health. And, you know, as a physician, we're in the same boat where people have done things for generations, but, you know, dentistry is medicine. It's a practice and an art. And it just really, again, I'm kind of stunned to know that people don't want to learn. I mean, the whole point is having a foundation and then growing from that foundation, which you, thank God, were able to do. Now, I want people to understand, because you gave a lot of symptoms that can be mistaken for a ton of other diseases. Yeah. I'm thinking of fungal toxicity, all sorts of POTS syndrome, all sorts of weird stuff. But in actuality, mercury, as you said, it's a toxin. So what are some of the symptoms? I know you gave us an overview, but what are some of, let's say, the main symptoms that people need to look out for?
Well, again, the mercury poisoning is very insidious, Dr. George. In the case of most people, it's a slow but steady poisoning that occurs over a period of time. It's rare that you have one acute exposure to mercury, unless it's an industrial accident or something along those lines. The problem with mercury, especially in the dental realm, is that it usually starts to begin at an early age. And therefore, depending on that child's, let's say, childhood, health and nutrition status, even status of the parents, symptoms could show up as, my gosh, any kind of neurological imbalance, which, you know, there are so many labels for things that are neurological based, all the spectrum disorders and so forth. But yet blood work tends not to show this, okay? And that's probably the reason why mercury doesn't get diagnosed. But further, things like irritability or more subtle symptoms like an irregular heartbeat here and there, or trouble sleeping, trouble concentrating, which we can call attention deficit disorder, or we can have gynecological problems. We can have fatigue, psychological problems, including mental illnesses like schizophrenia. Long-term could be Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases. The other common things are digestive disturbances. And oh gosh, the list goes on. And this is the reason why diagnosing a mercury toxicity is very difficult, because usually different people present differently to their doctor with different symptoms. And again, even if the doctor runs a blood test, rarely does mercury show up as being high, especially persons with the MTHFR gene mutations tend to not be able to, for example, excrete mercury as they get stored, they get exposed to it. But yet the mercury will be stored in body tissues away from the blood and therefore cannot be measured. So often the diagnosis goes unmade because there's nothing to indicate that there's a heavy metal poisoning going on. But yet some of these symptoms will be grouped into syndromes, which then can be labeled with something. And typically someone goes with three or four of the symptoms combined, they're going to have a certain medication ready for that. And that's the trap, is that most people, most patients are not educated enough on it to know, what is my reason for treating me? The physicians are only concerned with the symptoms that a patient is presenting with. And they're not, unfortunately, not able to dig deep and find out why this patient is sitting in their room. So again, everybody presents differently, but yet the symptoms can be very varied or subtle, depending on the amount of exposure and someone's genetic predisposition.
So let's talk about the teeth for a second, because the dental cardiac act, you know, that pathway is really very, very direct. And I'm not sure people understand that either. How important? Go ahead.
Well, it sure is. It's the one area that the medical and dental communities can agree on, is that we have an oral organ relationship. Okay. We're not talking systemic, where a physician would say, yes, if there's an incredible amount of bacteria in the mouth, that are bad bugs that could make its way to the heart and make a case for any kind of cardiac issue, ranging from endocarditis to any heart disease. So, you know, when persons, for example, have a leaky valve, or they have had a valve replacement or some other surgery, they have to pre-medicate prior to dental cleaning so as to kill the bacteria that we know are, you know, found in the mouth and will easily make their way to and around the heart. So there is that acknowledgement that there is a connection between dental microbiomes and the stuff we see around the heart, but yet that's where medicine stops. No other area of the body is acknowledged in, let's say, conventional medicine to have any connection to what's going on in the mouth. So a healthy mouth can definitely help keep your heart healthy. Again, there are many toxins and sources of toxins in the mouth, which we can certainly delve into to find out what are the things people need to be on the lookout for and what we should avoid or ask to avoid when visiting the dentist so as to not put their heart and their entire system at risk.
Well, let's go into those things. I mean, people, I know that there's a school of thought that fluoride rinses for children are a good thing. What's your take on that, for example?
Okay, great one. The fluoride thing is an issue of dose over time or dosage over time. So if we'll acknowledge, okay, in areas where there is public fluoridation, let's say municipal water supply has been fluoridated. Number one, this represents the only instance in history where there is a mass medication of people without obtaining their consent. So somehow Big Brother or the government decided that this is better for us, and yet those of us in the know disagree. But yet people are almost forced then to intake fluoride. And every child that's born in this country who goes to a physician starting at age 6 months will get fluoride exposure starting around age 6 months when mom is given the polybifluor vitamins to start giving the baby. The problem again is, depending on whether you lived in a fluoridated water area or not, and whether you had taken fluoride tablets, you know, with your multivitamin as a six-month-old or not, the concern we have with fluoride is that over time, it accumulates in the body. Okay, so dosage over time will allow fluoride to accumulate. And when given to a child, let's say someone younger than one, that fluoride, which is designed to, you know, ideally make the teeth stronger, doesn't just go to the teeth. The fluoride goes anywhere your bloodstream goes. And so the fluoride given intentionally, whether through the fluoridated water or the polybifluor vitamin, then is free to circulate anywhere in the body. And unfortunately, that means it can go in any organ or in the bones. And fluoride has a tendency to accumulate in the bones, leading to brittle bones if the exposure is high enough. We're noticing that it has a particular affinity for lowering IQ. All right. This has already been proven where in areas of mass fluoridation, IQ levels have dropped. Because fluoride affects thought processes, again, accumulates in the brain and has an interruption. So nobody is counting how much or taking accounting of how much fluoride an average individual is being exposed to in the course of their lifetime. And if that good little boy and good little girl is also using fluoridated toothpaste now, and even though they probably don't swallow it, there's still another systemic absorption every time somebody brushes their teeth with fluoride toothpaste. And that's the concern. Is that when nobody knows how much anybody's getting, no one is keeping accounting of how much someone is accumulating in their body. And when it does get to a certain level, there is no argument for anyone to say that high levels of fluoride is not toxic. We know this to be true. High levels of fluoride is exactly toxic. And that's a concern. And we don't know how much someone's getting. No one's keeping tabs on exactly how much someone is getting in the course of their lifetime. And so here's another case of chronic poisoning that usually starts at a young age. And then, of course, becomes cumulative over time.
I have a segue question to this. And that not only do people tend to get fluoride treatments, but people like the dentists on average like to pull teeth pretty quickly.
Yes.
Is there some sort of sequela to pulling teeth as opposed to trying to get the teeth healthy?
So typically, and the answer is yes to that question. Great question. But the answer is yes. Typically, when a tooth is going to be pulled out, it usually means that nothing else could be done for that tooth, or that in the case of, let's say, an older person, the supporting structures of the teeth, let's call them the periodontal complex, which is your gums and your bones, have been diseased and have deteriorated to the point where the tooth can't be supported and comes out. Other cases, the tooth is extracted because it's broken down. either through trauma, or it had option number three, which is root canal therapy, which ultimately led to the tooth breaking down or becoming reinfected again. The concern that we have is whether an infected tooth is extracted or even a non-infected tooth, for example, the third molars or wisdom teeth that most people commonly get pulled out. The reality is that the consequence of the extraction process will commonly or very often result in an incomplete healing of the jawbone where that tooth used to be. Now, over time, the gums and bone will close over the hole where that tooth was, and it'll look like there was never anything there. But inside the bone, there can be pockets of infection that are left behind or that are generated after the extraction that can plague people for years to come. We put a label or name these pockets of jawbone infection. We name them cavitations, not to be confused with cavities, which we call the decaying or rotting parts of a tooth, but a cavitation, again, indicating that the bone didn't heal well. Well, depending on where that bone is and where that tooth was extracted from, a biological dentist is going to be mindful of the fact that for every tooth or passing through every tooth, there is an acupuncture meridian that is affected one way or another when a tooth is healthy versus when it's not healthy or when it's extracted. And in many cases, these organs or teeth that are randomly extracted can then lead to dysfunction in another part of the body that is connected via the acupuncture meridian, whether it's a system, tissue, or organ. For example, an upper first molar, which many people wind up having root canals done on because it's in there for a while, is on the breast meridian. I've seen many women in my practice who had a root canal on the first or second molar on the upper jaw and develop a breast cancer. So that's an extreme relationship, but yet most dentists don't take the extraction process seriously enough to ensure that during the extraction itself, the bone is properly cleaned and prepared to allow proper and full healing so as to not create this imbalance, so as to not block the chi that flows through the acupuncture meridian to restore health. And then if someone needs an implant or is going to make a bridge or something, we don't have an issue. But not enough education has been provided to the surgeons either in dental school or in their residency to adequately address proper extraction. The residency you mentioned early in my introduction at Tufts University is now instructing surgeons to not be so timid when it comes to removing teeth and to properly clean the bone out during an extraction to facilitate blood flow running back into the extraction area in order to facilitate the repair. Again, dentists are quick to pull out teeth, and there's plenty of well-intentioned holistic dentists who are taught to remove teeth, take out what's called the periodontal ligament, and then put a bone graft in there. And in many cases, that doesn't go far enough. In fact, Dr. George, we could probably spend a whole 2 hours talking about what the shortcomings are of biological surgery compared to what conventional surgeons are doing. But it's suffice to say that an average extraction site doesn't truly heal. Even though there might not be any symptoms, these silent areas of infection may affect someone's health over the course of their lifetime and hardly ever get looked at unless the patient is presenting to a biological physician, someone who's got a degree in functional medicine, or someone else who's acutely aware of the connection between let's say root canals, extraction sites, and diseased teeth, and their effects outside of the mouth.
Wow, it's so complex. I mean,
it really is.
Amazing. On that note, let's take our second break and come back. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Fazio, and you have a website, holisticsmiles.com. People can go there and learn more about what you do, correct?
That's correct, Dr. George. I set it up in a way where if the patient navigates enough, hit enough of the drop-down menus to get a good education on not only what we do, the services we provide, and all that stuff, but I put enough information in there for people to learn about what they should be expecting from a biological dentist. We want people to be aware that there are certain pitfalls to avoid. Again, in the area, or I should say in the field of biological dentistry, the three common procedures that are done or concerns that we have in dentistry, in that field of dentistry, are mercury exposure from amalgam fillings, whole body toxicity from teeth treated by root canal therapy, and of course the fluoride, which we just talked about. I have plenty of information on there about that stuff, or at least be able to point people in the direction. Thankfully, you know, anybody can Google search those terms and educate themselves on the risk factors pertaining to those topics. On my website, we also talk about what someone should look for if they're wanting to get their mercury-containing fillings out, what the minimum safety protocols must be provided to the patient for by watching my videos and, again, getting some good information and actually even a question and answer sheet that a patient can print out to bring to their dentist and ask them, basically interview the dentist to find out, will this person be able to treat me properly? So, again, it's all about education here. We don't even have to advertise so much because people are now searching for it. But yet, if we can make it that much easier for someone to, you know, come across the information and start advocating for themselves, the only way they can do that is until they get educated. I would say that we're doing a pretty good job of that nowadays.
Well, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned root canals. That's another huge topic.
Huge.
And people tend to get them and not know what's happening. But it's not, is it a healthy thing? I don't think that it is, but what's your take on root canals in general?
Okay, here's my blanket statement. No one in my family is allowed to have root canal therapy. Let me qualify that. When an average person is being presented with the need for root canal therapy, okay, and I hate to use that word need because nobody needs root canal therapy, but typically if a tooth becomes infected for whatever means or it suffered a significant trauma in which the nerve or a nerve and blood supply and lymphatic tissue that's inside the tooth, which we call the pulp, if the pulp is injured and the tooth becomes non-vital or dies off, then the patient is presented with one of two options. One is root canal therapy to quote-unquote save the tooth or extraction of the tooth. Now, typically this is occurring in the dental chair and the patient is being given this ultimatum, essentially, hey, what do you want to do? You want to save your tooth or do you want to pull the tooth out? Most people would say, no, save my tooth, doc, please. You go, well, I can. And the dentist says, well, it's going to require root canal therapy. And the patient will say, okay, end of conversation. There's no conversation about, well, this might not work, or that in a year or two from now, you're going to have this tooth pulled out, or maybe 10 years from now, it might become reinfected again, or that it might present some other health challenge to your body. None of that ever comes up because the dentists are not taught this. Okay, so we can't blame the dentist who's doing it. I would say that 99% of the dentists out there are recommending root canal therapy because it is the last ditch effort in order to save the tooth, quote unquote, versus removing it. And so an average dentist thinks that they're doing the patient a tremendous service by saving their tooth. The dentist is the hero. And most patients are relieved to not extract the tooth and to keep their tooth in there. And even if it needs a crown to be put on it afterward, the tooth is still there. And usually that means that they think it's the end of the story. What in fact happens is that it's just the beginning of another story. So in the case of root canal therapy, if someone says, yes, do the root canal, the procedure of removing the pulp, which is using these small files to clean out the nerve and blood supply and lymphatic tissue from inside the roots of the tooth, sterilizing them and then putting a filling into the roots, pardon the expression, but much like putting a cork in a bottle. And by rights, that should be the end of the story. The reality is that, number one, it's impossible to completely sterilize any tooth, whether it's a little one in the front of the mouth, on the bottom jaw, or a big molar in the back. The inside of an average tooth is very complex, and therefore there are many microscopic nooks and crannies within an average tooth root that cannot physically be cleaned out. And conventional means of sterilizing the teeth, Dr. George, usually utilizes plain old Clorox bleach to irrigate or flush out the tooth during this procedure. Those liquids, or even if someone's using EDTA or peroxide or whatever, the problem is that liquids just do not flow well in tight spaces like the inside of a tooth. I like to explain to my patients that there is a property of liquids called surface tension that does not allow liquids to disperse very readily, especially in tight places. And so when a liquid is squirted inside of a tooth, if there is some debris, it can be flushed out, if you will, from the main canals, but it does nothing to address what branches off the main canals anywhere along the end of the root. And therefore, again, complexity of the inside of a tooth is too much for any one dentist to handle, meaning that we cannot grab out every last bit of nerve and blood supply or lymphatic tissue from inside that tooth. So even though a successful root canal, quote unquote, will have a relief of symptoms, pain, swelling, and so forth, and everybody's happy initially, there's no guarantee on how long that honeymoon period will be, meaning that there might be symptoms that pop up again later on, or the tooth may silently become reinfected and then presenting a situation that the body's immune system is then working overtime to control silently. And so the reality is that if we know that or accept that, we cannot sterilize a tooth right from the get-go. What allows us then to keep that tooth sterile for the course through the course of someone's lifetime? And the answer is there's nothing. So it's a decision that most patients are not getting enough information on before they say yes to the root canal. Again, it's very complex. The average dentist has no idea that they're doing any kind of harm. There's a whole specialty of root canals, trained dentists, who that's all they do. In which case, they're not going to be concerned with that. But the reality is that the studies that have been done outside of this country, okay, because we can't get those studies published here, that prove that root canal therapy is linked to chronic disease or acute disease, is overwhelming. Which is why I decided to go to Tufts University and get that residency in biological surgery, because it represents the first time in history that the term holistic / biological dentistry is being taught in an American dental school. However, the instructor that is bringing this information is not from this country, okay, from Germany. And that's why he has all the studies behind him to prove that root canals cause disease and are linked to degenerative diseases like pick any autoimmune disease, cancers, and neurological stuff. So again, the information is out there. It hasn't been available easily. There is a movie out called The Root Cause, which people can watch. It was done so well that the American Dental Association banned it within the first week of its release. And therefore, patients need to get educated on that subject. Root canal therapy will be a short-term solution only. It's not that I cannot offer it. I have to offer it to a patient if they want it. I don't do it. But if someone's tooth is in such a condition that it's either needing root canal therapy or being extracted, I educate the patient and say, look, here are the risks. What do you want to do about that? I do not put my personal feelings into the equation. I allow the patient to get educated. And if they're able to take some time to make that decision, then we're all about it. Sometimes that would mean taking some antibiotics to eliminate the infection first while the patient has some time to consider that decision, rather than committing to it right then and there under duress. So it's one of those things that's usually a high pressure situation. Most people are in pain or suffering, and they'll do anything to get out of pain or suffering. And root canal therapy does provide that service. Again, the concern is long-term, all right? In no other instance in all of medicine, and dentistry is under that umbrella, do we allow or force the body to hold on to a dead and infected tissue or organ, nowhere else. But somehow we find that it's okay to do that with our teeth. And until people start realizing that teeth are organs, then we can't expect that, you know, people who accept and receive root canal therapy are going to maintain their health, that over a period of time, some things are slightly going to, again, eventually going to start to happen and be mixed in the equation as to why someone's health starts to decline over time.
So then what are some of the options? I know that from other disease states, things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy or red light therapy have the ability to increase blood flow, to bring, you know, vital healing properties to the area. Is that something that works in the dental field?
Well, yes and no. I'm all about hyperbaric. I'm all about red light therapy. For persons who need surgery, it helps with repairing tissues. We could all use more oxygen for sure. The limitations, however, in the case of root canal therapy and these diseased jawbone areas, is that it's difficult to get the healing forces, remedies, whatever, to the site. Again, because the source of the problem is inside the tooth, it's difficult to get any of these remedies inside the tooth and stop the infection where it starts. Okay? The best we can do is try to clean up what's going on immediately outside of the tooth in the surrounding jawbone. But when a tooth's been infected long enough, the inflammation from that infection causes the body to attempt to isolate that area, either starting to form a cyst or, very intelligently, the body starts to lay down a very dense bone around these affected teeth, what we call an ischemic bone. And for our listeners, that means bone tissue that has very little to no blood flow in it as a result of this chronic infection. And therefore, even if we try to deliver other natural remedies to the area to fight the infection, there's a roadblock in the way. There is an inability to get the remedies to those spots. So the problem with the root canals is that, again, there's a source until you remove the source, we're really not doing much to eliminate the toxicity issue. So things like hyperbaric might help some symptomology. Things like red light might help with a healing crisis. But in and of itself, those two things would not do anything to cure the toxicity generated by root canals. The surgical removal of root canal treated teeth, which again, we alluded to before, has to involve removing all the roots, you know, as atraumatically as possible, and then cleaning out that diseased bone and actually drilling away bone if it became ischemic or what we call sclerotic until you get to fresh, clean marrow in which blood flow is filling back into the socket. Then someone could put their bone graft material in there mixed with their PRF. And then we're going to get true regeneration of the bony socket. And only then will the area be able to be restored to health.
Is there any benefit to implantation? There's a lot of implants going in now.
Yeah.
What's your take on them? I mean, some of them are titanium based. I would think that's not the best.
That's a great question. And yes, Dr. George, I agree with your assessment. Titanium, ask any surgeon now who's biological, we all shied away from titanium. We all learned on titanium because that was all we had. But mm-hmm. the advent, or I should say emergence of zirconia implants, which is a ceramic style implant, has really taken the world of biological surgery by storm. Thankfully, the material itself, the zirconia, is very what we call biocompatible, which means that the material is very well received by the average human being. The body tissues, including the bone and gum tissue that are in direct contact with that implant, love the material. And there's a great integration process or fusion of that material with the jawbone. It's really remarkable. With titanium, we have a completely different scenario. The problem with titanium, number one, is that it's a metal, okay? And as biological, as crazy biological dentists, we don't like metals to be used in the mouth. But yet, titanium does function very well, being that it's a noble metal. Surgical grade titanium is truly pure titanium and not an alloy. And that's all well and good, except that when we place a titanium root or implant into the jawbone, if there are any other metals already in the mouth, there can be what we call a galvanic reaction or interaction between the titanium root and other metals that are already in the mouth. But to compound that issue even further, is that when the titanium implant root tends to get restored, let's say 4 to 6 months later, the crown or bridge goes on there, invariably other metal components are used in conjunction with the restoration of that titanium implant. And Dr. George, that means that we set up in the implant itself a circuitry. You have, for example, we'll have the titanium root, we'll have what we call an abutment, which is a piece of material that is connected to the implant, and then the crown is either cemented to that or is fused to that. So in the case of titanium implant, we usually have three components, three parts to that implant. The titanium root, the abutment, which might be titanium, might not be, and then the crown that goes on it, which might be a gold alloy or some other metal alloy. So that represents one tooth structure that has three separate alloys in it. The net result, again, is that the crown will be very reactive with other materials around the mouth. The titanium root will, over time, start to release titanium ions into the surrounding jawbone as a result of this galvanic current or galvanism, that will be modified or increased if there's mercury in there or if there's gold materials elsewhere in the mouth. So the concern with titanium is that it does not, number one, it does not biofuse like the zirconia does. Titanium integration of the jawbone is truly just a mechanical integration with the threads of the implant. But yet they're strong, they're durable, they can last a long time. The concern we have is that it's still metal. So if we're feeling if there is an alternative that does not create that galvanic current, that does not create that circuitry that can start reacting or interacting with other metals that are already in the mouth, then we're all about it. And the ceramic implant then can be restored with the same exact material with the crown, also made of zirconia, and therefore becomes pretty inert. And if that implant is placed into truly healthy bone, again, if the root canal or whatever tooth that was there previously was removed correctly and the bone was restored to true health, then a ceramic implant, someone can expect to last their entire life and be healthy and not worry about any kind of deleterious effect or have any kind of creation of infections or symptoms related to the material itself. So titanium implants, they're okay. We feel that zirconia implants are better. And again, the studies coming out now out of Europe are going to suggest or kind of confirmed for us what we all know, is that we should stay away from the metals and cut the risk factor down by sticking with the zirconia. And then you don't have to worry about compatibility issues or allergy potential that certain metals provide to people.
Excellent. On that note, let's take our last break and come back. Sure. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. This is a really great conversation, Dr. Fazio, because it just there's so many choices out there. You feel, like you said, when you go to the dentist, you're kind of under duress and you just do whatever you're asked to do. But knowledge is power on this. And
yes,
you just described so many ways that people can save their teeth. And if they have to lose them, they can actually get implants that are not going to be toxic or deleterious.
Well, correct.
Now, how can, for the people who are not at that extreme state, but, you know, they come in and they have teeth that need some help. Let's say they have cavities, et cetera.
Yeah.
What's your take on how we can keep people from needing to get to that point of having a tooth implant?
So, again, we have to start when they're children. All right. And let's take, for example, an average child that comes in. The earlier we intervene, of course, the better it is, right? Early detection is key. But the way that we kind of get the best dental work is no dental work, right? So the only perfect thing is what God had intended for us, which is a healthy human being that lives well, breathes well, sleeps well, eats well, and is happy. In those persons, disease is very low. But typically what we're seeing, a trend, and Dr. George, you probably have seen this in your own practice, the preponderance of airway restrictions that we're seeing in children. I would say it's almost a generational thing where many of these children are that I'm seeing in my practice are mouth breathing because they're having either a tongue restriction or probably not being breastfed or any number of issues that they might have been exposed to while the mother was pregnant. But in those cases, we're screening all of our children to make sure that, number one, the airway is patent and viable. And if it isn't, then check the child for tongue restriction. Perhaps consider things like myofunctional therapy to enhance the complex between the lips, the tongue, and the teeth, which helps to grow the teeth. Taking that a step further, by doing that or addressing that, we can get to the point where kids don't even need their braces anymore, because an unrestricted tongue can lead to better sleep, better breathing, and full jaw development. So children who are fortunate to be breastfed for 2 to 3 or 4 years get that exercise with their tongue. Suckling from the mother is a completely different thing than it is when drinking from a formula bottle. In those cases, the tongue, in the case of the latter, the tongue gets lazy and doesn't help with the development. So starting from childhood, children become prone to cavity formation before they even get to the dentist, if they're not breathing well, if their tongue is lazy or restricted, and if they're not sleeping well, their mouth dries out, their mouth breathing, that increases the likelihood of them getting cavities, okay? Now, for children who are breastfed and get past that, of course, we can say that another risk factor is poor diet, okay? So if we're, you know, seeing these kids who come in and mom and dad are aghast when I tell them that there's 5 or 6 or 10 cavities, and they'll say to me, this kid's never had a drop of sugar, and that's impossible. And I will tell them, okay, mom, let's go back to pregnancy. And let me ask you, if your OBGYN checked to see if your vitamin D3 levels are adequate, was there any other consideration to making sure you're providing yourself and your unborn child adequate amount of minerals and trace minerals to help, you know, grow this child and these teeth before the baby's born? Rarely is anybody going back that far. But what we can control is what's going on now. So if a child's coming in and there are cavities, we can't tell mom, look, we can't go back, you know, and start over. What we can say is what we're dealing with now and how do we go forward. So if the kid has some fillings, if the cavities are beyond the enamel layer into the dentin layer, which is under the enamel, then they have to be drilled and filled. No, there's no protocol as far as a remineralization protocol that will work once that cavities progress to a certain part. If the cavities have not progressed deeply, if they're just showing up as a very early stage, then again, we're talking about the children population. We're going to say, all right, time to intervene. Let's recommend a dietary tweak. Let's find out, you know, best that we can. And this is all about what biological dentistry is about. We got to take into account the social history as well, social and medical histories, when deciding what's best for our patient. And so what we can do is see if there's anything that's really out of whack. And again, in my practice, most of the new parents, they're seeking me out because they're already thinking and they're already living this lifestyle. We just need to kind of tweak some things. And the most two common things that we'll recommend are getting an vitamin D3 levels measured. And if they're low, supplementing with vitamin D3. Now, those of us live here in the Northeast, we don't get enough sun to make enough adequate levels of vitamin D3. So it becomes even more critical for my patients to be on vitamin D3 supplements for most of the year in order to help the body help itself. So we're suggesting vitamin D3 with the K2 in it in combination with a good mineral source. And at least at that point, we're giving the body the basic tools it needs to uptake minerals and get them to where we need them, which is in the long bones, the jaw bones, and the teeth. And so sometimes we're playing catch up. In a lot of cases, we're playing catch up with the disease state, which is what we refer to cavities as, a disease of imbalance, not a oral hygiene issue. Then where our main concern then becomes for the permanent teeth, right? So as much as mom and dad won't like the fact that their kid's going to have to get fillings at certain, for certain children, certain kids can get by with the remineralization protocol and not allow the cavities to progress to the point that they need to be drilled and filled. Once people have gotten to adulthood, then it's a completely different game. Then diet, and to a certain degree, genetics is playing the role. And so, again, we still use the same principles of looking at nutrition and making suggestions about what to give the body to allow the teeth and the saliva and the jaw bones and everybody to work in harmony to keep things healthy. Not everybody is compliant with that stuff, but at least the information is out there. So again, nutritional approaches, when we do have to do work, we're trying to be as conservative as possible. And the other thing is, as we alluded to with root canals in the biological office, we're all about preventing root canal therapy. Whereas many dentists will, based on if a tooth is not infected, but yet it looks like there's a deep cavity, for example, on an x-ray, the dentist is going to tell the patient, look, you're going to need a root canal, post and a crown because this cavity is so deep. And we're not going to be able to save the tooth without doing that. In a biological office, we're saying, oh no, even if the cavity is really deep and it looks like it's sitting right on top of where the nerve and blood supply is, we'll say, okay, we're going to save this tooth. We're going to clean out the cavity as much as we can without mechanically exposing the nerve, meaning we're not going to drill into the nerve area. At that point, we then stop. And then we get our ozone machine and we draw up some ozone gas and we essentially fumigate the inside of the teeth. In certain cases, maybe even get a laser to do some photobiomodulation or red light therapy, essentially inside of the tooth, and then carefully fill over that with a non-toxic resin material and save the tooth. And additionally, we'll give some nutritional support during that time to allow for the inflammation to die down and for the tooth to calm down and heal up, in which case then we prevent the need for root canal therapy. That has been probably the most rewarding aspect of my doing my work, placing amalgam fillings and watching people get healthy, but preventing and avoiding root canal therapy and the gratitude our patients express following that is really a great thing. And I think if dentists out there, if there's anybody listening, if they embrace this entire philosophy, would realize that there's so much more to the job when we're getting to people, helping them with their health and not only recover their health, but maintain it. This kind of prevention or emphasis on prevention is really important. Again, not what we're taught in school. We're just taught to treat symptoms and don't be bothered with why. Just don't ask why. Just ask when and can we do it now? So again, different dentists have different skill sets. I think that in our office, like most biological offices, preventing the root canals, using biological materials or materials that don't create challenges to our health is the best way to avoid teeth being extracted and the best way to maintain health.
I couldn't have said it better. You know, we don't have a lot of time left, maybe about a minute or so, but I wanted to ask you a quick question about toothpaste that have a hydroxyapatite.
Yes.
Is that worth buying?
Yes. But Dr. George, the patients will, or I should say your listeners out there are probably going to see a little confusion or maybe experience a little confusion. We love hydroxyapatite, okay? Because it's the basic building blocks of your enamel and bone. Okay, bone graft materials tend to include hydroxyapatite. It's a great material. And the thinking is that by applying hydroxyapatite topically onto the surface of the teeth, that it will help replenish the surface of the enamel. And the answer is yes, it does. The only concern I have is that there's a trend that I've noticed. For example, I just went to Amazon. Well, a few days ago, I was showing a patient. I typed in hydroxyapatite toothpaste. And a list of toothpaste came up, and we scrolled down from one to one to the next and to the next. And virtually every one of them said on the label, nano hydroxyapatite. Nano referring to the particle size of the hydroxyapatite. On paper, a nano-sized particle sounds great because smaller will be able to penetrate into the microscopic porosities of the enamel layer and ideally be more nourishing to the tooth surface. The problem is that the stuff that doesn't go into the tooth, that gets mixed with your saliva, maybe mixed with someone's blood, these nano-sized particles can go anywhere. And we're worried about them, if someone's doing this with any regularity, that over time, these nano-sized particles may start traveling into interstitial tissues, maybe getting lodged in the pineal gland or maybe getting lodged in any other organ. And so, again, now we're concerned with dose over time, exposure to something that, although isn't necessarily toxic, which is worried about where's that stuff going. So although we like hydroxyapatite, we want our users, we want our patients to use a toothpaste that just says hydroxyapatite without the nano precursor. So those are larger particles, and then therefore we're not worried about them, you know, traveling to places that we don't want them to go. But as a toothpaste medicament, I say that a toothpaste containing hydroxyapatite is awesome. Usually those preparations will also have other natural ingredients. Most of the, you know, newer manufacturers are getting hit to the fact that there's a whole new market of people who want all natural stuff out there. Thankfully, we have this stuff today.
That's good to know. You know, time goes way too fast. I have to have you come back because I'm sure we scratched the surface, but really, I'd love to delve further.
I would love that, Dr. George, because as you alluded to, there are a lot of considerations and it's hard to, you know, couch it all into one interview. I would love to maybe take certain subjects one by one and spend the whole, whole segment just going over the thing. There is that much. With fluoride, maybe not so much, but with the root canals and the whole surgical thing and the amalgams and all the other considerations, there's quite a bit of information to be had. But thankfully, you know, our listeners can then just do, like I said earlier, do a Google search about natural dentistry or holistic dentistry and start educating themselves on what they need to look for, what they should be requesting, what they should be avoiding, and the pitfalls that come with.
Agreed. In the seconds that we have left, how can people find you and go to your website and learn more about what you do?
They could type in my name, Dr. Leonard Fazio in New York. Probably going to come up on page one on Google. You can go to my website, www.holisticsmiles.com. Again, my website has a lot of information on there. If someone types in my name directly, they can look at old videos and other interviews and stuff that we've done over the years. And again, it was all about educating. And if they go to my website, there's a place to drop an email if they want, if they have any specific questions, or even want to be pointed in the right direction. In that case, I'll be glad to, you know, give people the information they can maybe find a biological dentist near them that be able to switch to. There are two main organizations in this country: the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, and the International Academy of Oral Medicine, Biological Dentistry and Medicine, have a lot of information on their websites as well for the general public. So, including a search directory to find a dentist who's been trained, but also, again, the focus on education. Let them get some unfettered access to this, what used to be really radical information that's now thankfully becoming more mainstream. It's now much easier. I'm sorry. It's much easier now for someone to find a biological dentist like me in their own neighborhood.
Well, I'm so blessed to have you on the show again. I will definitely have you come back.
I'll look forward to it.
It was awesome. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk Events.